The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, a visit with our faithful, in both senses of the word, film critic Richard Oliva. This time, not to review films, but to talk about the making of a critic, specifically a Catholic critic. Richard has written for the Catholic journals Crisis and Commonweal, and one of his essays about being a Catholic critic was anthologized in a collection of best movie writing that was edited by Peter Bogdanovich. Back in a moment with Richard, but first reminding you that our spring pledge drive needs your help. Please support the kind of unusual music and public affairs programming that WESU has made it its mission to bring you for 80 years. Please go to WESUFM.org/pledge and give what you can. Thanks.
Yesterday, when I was young, so many happy songs were waiting to be sung, so many wild pleasures lay in store for me, and so much pain my dazzled eyes refused to see.
Welcome back, Richard Oliva.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Maria.
This time we don't have movies, particularly a movie to talk about or an Oscar season to unpack. We are going to talk about you.
Oh, so this is my autobiography.
There. We are going to talk about the making of a Catholic critic.
Mm. Well,
Portrait of the artist as a young man.
Portrait of the critic as a young man.
Right.
Well, I was very young when I realized that there were such things as film critics. I was 13 years old, as a matter of fact. I remember that year, 1961, if anybody wants to date me. And it all began, let me see, in a barber shop, as a matter of fact. A barber shop and Esquire magazine were the determining factors.
Okay.
It was a neighborhood barber shop. Patronized mostly by men, really, yeah. Really a men's barbershop. And I was sent there once a month by my father when my hair got too long. And for some reason, they didn't take appointments there. It was just first come, first serve. And I always had to go on a Saturday because I was a kid going to school and I wasn't going to a barbershop at night. One month, I think it was a September in 61, but I'm not too exact about that.
My goodness.
I was in the barbershop. And I never brought a book to read, even though I was a great reader. I don't know why. But sometimes I had to wait for a haircut for, 20 minutes, half an hour, depending on who was ahead of me. And I would pick up some of the magazines on the central table. And since it was a men's barbershop, there are things like the Police Gazette. Nobody remembers that anymore.
No. It crime?
Yeah, crime. Yeah. Police, Tough Guy magazines and police magazines and hunting and fishing. No, I wasn't interested in any of that stuff. But there was an Esquire magazine, and I think it had on the cover Yvette Mimieux in a bikini. Now, I don't know if your listeners remember Yvette Mimieux.
Even Esquire magazine. Still exists.
It still exists.
Do people know what it's kind of like?
People don't remember that Esquire magazine was like the leading popular intellectual magazine next to The New Yorker, both popular and intellectual. Not a little magazine like the Partisan Review or The New Republic, but not a pop magazine either like Life magazine. It was popular but with intellectual content. And the reason for that was back in the 30s, I guess. The publishers, or I should say the 40s, the late 40s, Esquire editors realized that Hugh Hefner with Playboy magazine was out playboying them with nudes and so forth. And Esquire magazine decided we've really got to beef this up intellectually and maybe feature only one photo display of a beautiful actress in a bathing suit and a bikini. And I think it was Yvette Mimieux on the cover of the one I'm thinking of.
Makes me want to look it up.
Yeah. 61. She was in The Time Machine. She's the beautiful elfin girl that Rod Taylor saves in a movie that nobody remembers anymore, Light in the Piazza with Olivia de Havilland. Quite a good movie, actually. Anyway, I was looking at Yvette Mimieux in her bikini, and I flipped through the pages, and I came across a movie column. And the movie column was written by somebody called Dwight McDonald. Now, I don't know how many people remember him either, although one of his books has just been reissued by the New York Review Press, Against the American Grain, filled with great articles on American popular culture. And he had been hired away from The New Yorker, although he still contributed to The New Yorker, but he was hired by Esquire to write a regular monthly film column. And I started reading this thing because, hey, it's movies. You know, what could be more fun than that? Movies are fun. Movies were, you know, the national time waster in a fun way.
Right.
And I said, why is somebody writing a column about the movies? And as I read, I felt this seems to be a very witty, intelligent man, and he's just writing about pop entertainment. Dwight McDonald was an ex-Trotskyite, friend of Dorothy Day, great friend of James Agee, very, very witty essayist on pop culture. And he had taken on this post as film critic, and he just lambasted the current products of Hollywood. And back in 1950s and the early 1960s, you know, it was Pillow Talk with Doris Day and Rock Hudson, and this and that bestseller turned into a stodgy movie. A stodgy bestseller turned into an even stodgier movie. It was really, he just lambasted all his junk. And he started to review the new products coming out of Europe. And Europe was going through a revolution in movie making. And there were movie makers who had been working for 10 or 15 years, but now were really coming into their own. Filmmakers like Fellini, Antonioni, Ingmar Bergman. And he was reviewing these new wonderful artworks coming into America, just being imported in the early 60s. But in this particular column, I was really lucky in this regard because he reviewed three classics, and I knew the names of these classics. I wouldn't have known anything about Ingmar Bergman or Antonioni, but he re-reviewed three classics, Gone with the Wind, The Public Enemy, great gangster movie with James Cagney, and The Birth of a Nation, now a very notorious movie, more notorious than ever. And he pointed out things in them. I had seen two of these three movies, Gone with the Wind and Public Enemy. And he pointed out things in these movies that I felt were true, but I could never have articulated for myself. And with Gone with the Wind, I expected, oh, this is intellectual. He'll really criticize this film, really tear it to pieces. But no, he said, for all its sentimentality about the old South, Gone with the Wind, blah, 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 for all that, this is an adult movie. And that made me sit up. What's so adult about it? He pointed out that the tension between Scarlett O'Hara's telling herself to fall in love with Ashley Wilkes because Ashley was the perfect gallant gentleman of the Old South, and Scarlett's real sexual response to Rhett Butler, who is as pragmatic and as vital and as unscrupulous as she was, this tension in the woman gave the movie a real psychological edge, and that made it an adult film. And I thought, well, I've never thought of that before, but I felt it was true, and I was excited by the distinctions he was making. Then he came to The Public Enemy, and he said, this is a great gangster movie because it's so economical. and so relatively nonviolent that it's a work of art in itself. You don't need loads of violence and bloodshed to make a gangster movie. Look at what the art of the director does. The director in this case was William Wellman. And McDonald focused on one scene. A stool pigeon was being bumped off by James Cagney. Well, Cagney and his best friend, another gangster, walk into the stool pigeon's room, and they make it clear they're going to execute him, and the stool pigeon desperately plays the piano to distract them and is giving off all sorts of blarney and nonsense and playing the piano. And the camera turns away from James Cagney and the stool pigeon, focuses on the friend who's not doing anything but standing there. And on the friend's face, you see a startled look when you hear a gunshot off screen, and then you hear the plonk, plonk, plonk of the piano and crash. The stool pigeon has just been shot in his head, or maybe his hands, or maybe the upper part of his body has just crashed down on the keyboard. Mm-hmm. What a great way, with these discordant chords, this discordant sound, this crash, to indicate the violence instead of just blatantly showing it. And that made me aware what the director does. What does the director point the camera at? And why does he point the camera at that? Then McDonald really got down to basics, and he went to Birth of a Nation, which he abhorred sociologically and morally because it's a racist movie. And Dwight McDonald was a progressive. I mean, the last person in the world to praise that movie morally. But he said, wait, this movie really gives us the building blocks of cinema. It really was a step forward in artistry and in technique. It's not a great moral document and therefore not a great work of art, but these are the building blocks of cinema. And he focused on one of the worst shots in the movie. It's called the Mulatto's Mad Scheme, which is the most racist caption. And in it, this one shot, a man of mixed race is proposing marriage to a fluttery young female of the Old South. And, of course, she just abhors the fact that a black man is proposing marriage to her. This is during Reconstruction. And McDonough pointed out, morally, this is a horror. But there is such racism in D.W. Griffith, which he's trying to express in this one shot, that the movie takes on a kind of lurid, mythic quality that makes your skin crawl. And it's just that one shot that does it. And McDonough pointed out, these are the building blocks. Shot after shot make up what cinema is.
What was it about the shot?
The so-called mulatto, actually played by a white man in blackface, proposing to the girl is just, his face is just filled with lust, and the white girl's face is appalled. And that, and the way D.W. Griffith situated them, sat them next to each other, and something about the photography, something about the way he positioned the bodies, made it clear that the filmmaker himself was filled with horror.
Wow.
And McDonald said, yes, you can feel repelled by the immorality of it all, but it's that feeling of horror, a different kind of horror than D.W. Griffith intended. He intended to be horrified by a black man proposing to a white woman. How terrible. But actually what you feel in the audience is, oh my gosh, this is what brought Reconstruction down and the failure of the federal government to intervene in these cases. The racism was just appalling. And McDonald's point was, yes, you can read a book word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, but it's not enough to let a movie flow over you. You have to read a movie as well. And it's like the shot is maybe a sentence, and a series of shots make up a paragraph, and a long sequence makes up a chapter, as in a novel. Now, when I was in school, my teachers, with some justification, would tell me, oh, reading is so superior to being at the movies because the movies just flow over you and you don't have to think. But when you read, you have to decipher the words. as quickly as possible, and your brain really has to work. Therefore, reading exercises of the brain, movies are lazy. And McDonald just opposed all that. He says, if you're lazy and let the movie flow all over you, of course it seems like a lazy non-art. But if you're really reading a movie, if you're paying attention to where the camera is, what the lighting is like, what the colors are like, what the facial expressions of the actors are like, listening to the dialogue, coordinating that in your mind with what you're seeing visually, what's going on the soundtrack, is music being used or not, there's a thousand things to attend to. You have to be on the edge of your seat to catch everything. So you have to read the movie. In this case, read the movie in order to withstand the racism and take in whatever is good in Birth of a Nation.
I can just imagine the seismic effect this had on you as a kid in the barbershop.
It did.
Yeah, that's a lot to be...
It shook me up, and it made me look at something that I had just considered fun junk in a new way, and I saw, yes, it could be a work of art. But how many works of art were there to see at that time in Waterbury, Connecticut, where I come from? There was no art theater there at that time, but there were two or three in New Haven. And my good parents graciously rode me to New Haven. Well, the whole family went once every 2 weeks to New Haven to see whatever was on at the Lincoln Theater, which is right near Yale. And, of course, it catered to the students there and was showing the latest Fellini, the latest Antonioni, the latest Bergman. And my father, who wasn't used to art movies, rather than feeling that this is a bore, I'm just doing it to please my son, he perked up and really started to get into this himself, partly because he was Italian-American, the son of immigrants. And when he looked at the new Fellinis and movies like The Easy Life, he was particularly startled by a movie called The Easy Life, which is not the accurate translation of the title. It's a movie by Dino Risi starring Vittorio Gassman. And in that film, the two heroes, Jean-Louis Trintignant and Vittorio Gassman, give a ride to an elderly man at the side of the road, and my father just sat up straight in his chair and said, oh my God, that's my father. That's the way he looked.
Wow.
And he became fascinated by the new Italian films.
Wow.
But even the French and he even got to like Ingmar Bergman. So it was like an education for him as well as for me. And my mother, who was a PhD in Italian literature, she loved it too.
Wow.
So it became a biweekly trip, and I did take in these new wonderful foreign films that Dwight McDonald was writing about. And I started to read other critics. McDonald only came out once a month. And I discovered at least three other critics. I discovered first Stanley Kaufman, who began writing criticism for Show magazine. Yeah, that's defunct. It was a Huntington-Hartford magazine. And he was then hired on a regular basis by the New Republic. And he wrote wonderful criticism every single week.
Wow.
Had different tastes, different likes and dislikes from McDonald, which was good because it opened up the fact to me is good critics are not going to agree. And debate is what counts. Then I discovered John Simon writing for a little left-wing Trotskyite magazine called The New Leader. He was subsequently hired by a right-wing magazine, the National Review by William F. Buckley. And he wrote for that regularly. And finally, I discovered Pauline Kael, who was skipping around from Life magazine to Good Housekeeping and getting fired for not praising The Sound of Music, and finally found a home at The New Yorker. And at that time, so I started reading those three critics regularly, especially after Dwight McDonald retired. So that was an education in criticism by reading good critics. And I learned by reading them that not only will they have fruitful disagreements with one another, but that they could read films in completely different ways from the way I was trying to educate myself. I was kind of indoctrinated by McDonald, but then I learned different viewpoints from these other critics. And Pauline Kael reintroduced me to popular movies like Fred Astaire musicals and Funny Face and Charade with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, movies I'd already liked and appreciated as fun. She said there's art in fun. There's art in popular entertainment. And you needn't worship all these foreign films. Some of them are actually quite self-indulgent and bad. But there's art in Hollywood, too. So she gave me kind of a thorough re-education after McDonald and Kaufman. So, again, this is learning how to read the movie.
If you are just joining us, we are visiting with film critic Richard Oliva, semi-retired from the Catholic journal Commonweal, about how he got into the criticism game. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Richard.
Hey, I'm DJ Cheshire Cat. Many people think incorrectly that the media, be it the radio, the television, or the newspaper, are the province of the corporations or the governments. No, they're ours. And here at WESU, we make that true. We can volunteer, we can take control of the airwaves, broadcast what we want to broadcast, and say what we want to say. But we need your help. We need the help of people who want to volunteer and also pledge donations to keep us commercial-free and community-supported.
Donate online at www.wesufm.org.
You're still a young man, baby. Ooh, don't waste your time. You're still a young man, baby. Ooh.
Okay. Wow, this is fascinating. I should say, the inspiration for this conversation was my learning that an article you wrote about being a Catholic movie critic was anthologized in a book called The Best American Movie Writing, 1999, edited by none other than Peter Bogdanovich.
And placed right between Gore Vidal and director James Mangold, a very, very good young up-and-coming director. So
really?
I was in good company.
Very impressive.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to establish that, you know, how this came to be, because it's quite impressive. But also, I'm curious about two things. One is, can you remember your first ever movie review?
Yes.
And can you talk about being a particularly Catholic critic?
Well, I was hired by a Catholic magazine called Crisis. It was actually called Catholicism in Crisis.
Had you been writing criticism before that?
No. I've been experimenting writing movie reviews here and there. And now and then I drag in a movie to illustrate some a comparison with a play or a book in my academic papers. But a friend of mine was the managing editor of Catholicism in Crisis. His boss was Michael Novak.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and they hired me temporarily just to see what I could do. And the first movie I reviewed for them was Rambo with Sylvester Stallone.
Did you like it?
No, I didn't like
not
it
at all.
But I did see something important in it, because you can see something important even in a bad movie. I considered it really bad, and I said so. But I said, "But wait a minute, this is not the Republican Party movie people take it to be. This is actually an anarchistic film of extreme individualism. It's not particularly good, except for a couple of good action sequences. But this movie has more to do with the frontier figure in our literature, like Natty Bumppo, Hawkeye, and James Fenimore Cooper, you know, the last of the Mohegans. That anarchistic, individualistic figure going it alone on the in the great frontier, this is what Rambo is descended from. And I tried to establish, yes, I don't consider it a good movie, but it is tapping into a lineage of American heroes. And it's not the exactly the right-wing Republican Reagan-esque movie that people are taking it to be.
See, you absorbed that nuanced approach from the reading you'd done, it sounds like.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I read Fenimore Cooper and other American heroes, and I also got something out of an article by D.H. Lawrence in Studies in American Literature, and I even quoted a few lines from him in the Rambo Review. Apparently, Novak was impressed and said, yeah, hire him on a regular basis, and I worked for Catholicism in Crisis for about 2 years, and then I Commonweal went fishing, and they detected this guy's kind of liberal for them, and we've lost our old reviewer, and they poached me.
So you were liberal for Crisis?
Yeah, well, I was more liberal than most of the writers.
I see. You'd be a better fit with them.
Well, that's what Commonweal thought.
Yeah.
Crisis wasn't exactly happy about letting me go, but they weren't too unhappy either, because I had also reviewed, at the end of 2 years, I had reviewed, more than 2 years. It was the end of 4 years. I reviewed The Last Temptation of Christ for Crisis. They wanted a real pan of that film. Well, alas, I love the movie. I had some reservations. I noted them, but I said, no, this is not the scandalous movie that people are taking it to be. In fact, people who are picketing this movie aren't even seeing it, or they would see that, no, Jesus does not have sex during the movie, so what you are picketing doesn't exist, and therefore you are misjudging the movie. So I said all that, and to their credit, Crisis printed it intact.
Wow.
No censorship. And they were pretty unhappy with it anyway. And so when I was hired away by Commonweal, they probably let me go with some relief.
So interesting. What year are we in now when you go to Commonweal?
Commonweal, 1990.
So Commonweal, as much as it might have had a larger circulation than Catholicism in Crisis, was still a pretty kind of specialized.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Catholic to its core. So that was, in both cases, both magazines, that felt like a good fit for you, were you?
Yeah, because I felt that Catholic critic isn't somebody who drags in dogma into his review, nor does he or she interpret all the symbols in the movie to make a Roman Catholic point. Mm-hmm. Instead, you bring all of yourself into a review. And at some core of myself, I was Catholic.
You're a Catholic.
And am Catholic. Kind of an anemic Catholic, because I'm not a regular churchgoer.
Reasonably Catholic.
But reasonably Catholic, just like this perfect for this program. But I felt that there were two things. Being a Catholic, you're, like Alfred Hitchcock says, you know, who was educated by Jesuits, you know, once you've been educated by Jesuits or educated by any sort of Catholic teachers, whether they be priests or nuns or even laity, you become awakened to moral struggle. And, you know, good and evil mean a lot to you. And the struggle to do the right thing, or, as with some Graham Greene novels, to do the wrong thing, is a kind of moral struggle that has to be traced by the storyteller, whether it be a novelist or a film director or a playwright. It has to be traced by the artist, the dramatic artist, to create a structure for the story. In other words, the structure of the story has to follow the moral struggle of the hero or heroine. And that's a very Catholic thing. And many of the movies nowadays are static to me. They don't move dramatically because there's no moral struggle. So that's part of my Catholicism. The other thing, the other point I would make is that My Catholicism tells me not to judge people, and therefore not fictional characters, too quickly. André Gide is famous for having said, please don't understand me too quickly. And I bring that to the characters in a fiction. I try not to understand them too quickly. Because in Catholicism, there's a kind of, and I think this line was first written by G.K. Chesterton, I think, The Democracy of the Dead. Hmm. That is, we're all, dead or alive, we're all being judged in the eyes of God. Not dismissed, not condemned right away, but no matter what our position is in society, we're part of the democracy of the dead, the all of mankind struggling to realize himself or herself, and that we mustn't too quickly use dogma to sentence people to the fires of hell.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, life's a struggle. Life's a struggle. And therefore, when the Legion of Decency condemns Jules and Jim, an important foreign movie of that time, I would say, no, Legion of Decency can't condemn it for me. Jules and Jim is about a moral struggle about three people who probably break the rules of Judeo-Christianity, but still they're struggling to do something in their lives that they don't regard as evil. Let's watch them with some patience, some Christian patience.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, gosh, so many thoughts, especially regarding the contemporary crop of movies and maybe also criticism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're saying that there's no moral struggle, I mean, it's tempting to say it's because there are no morals, you know, then what's to become of a Catholic movie critic? Mm. You know, you sit there and you go, there's no there.
Well, like, there's no there if you're just judging them by the rules of, I don't want to say, but the rules of Catholicism. If Catholicism has narrowed your mind so that people are either black or white.
Yeah,
you should not be a critic of the arts.
Okay.
But if Catholicism has broadened your sympathy for humankind, then you can be a critic of the arts. But your Christianity or even just your Catholicism should alert you when somebody is just indulging themselves in, let's say, violence, which is a bigger problem than sex, or even gratuitous sex. But the violence is a more important problem. I think my Catholicism led me to realize that a movie like Natural Born Killers, for instance, is a really bad movie. Pauline Kael would agree that it's a bad movie, but she said, this movie gives off bad vibrations, and I don't like it. With me, it's not just bad vibrations. Oliver Stone in this movie is dividing mankind into sheep and goats and sending the sheep to the slaughter. I mean, this movie has absolutely innocent people getting killed, but the movie takes a position that everybody deserves to be killed sooner or later, and my heroes are the natural born killers, are just the people who do it. And there's all sorts of phony postures taken by this movie, that it tries to be anti-gun or it tries to be anti-capital punishment, but it's all quite superficial, and it's just a cover-up for the fact that Oliver Stone wants to see his characters on screen slaughtering as many people as possible, because he knows he's good. He's a good left-wing Buddhist, and all these other people are dastardly, I don't know, Republicans or something. Let's shoot them up. I mean, that's what's really there in that movie.
So interesting.
Under a superficial coating of liberal anti-gun or liberal anti-capital punishment, all that rings false. What's really at the heart of that movie is Stone's contempt for mankind.
Fascinating. Yeah. It's a well-regarded movie, though, isn't it?
It's come to be. It always has gotten mixed reviews. It's come to be well-regarded by critics who are trying to be
hip and happening
and cutting edge and in your face, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about maybe another example or two. This is kind of interesting. Any other movies come to mind that just feel what shall I say, worthless?
Worthless. I tend to forget those. I just saw a movie yesterday, High Life.
High Life.
By an extremely talented French director, Claire Denis. Very good director. She spent her childhood in the French territories of Africa, what used to be the French-held territories of Africa. It was brought up there. Has a special feeling for Africa, for the black people of Africa, for the white people of Africa who once ruled the land and had the blacks working for them. Very talented woman when she makes movies on that theme and in that place. Very, very, very good director. But she's made this science fiction, High Life, which I just saw yesterday, and she can't make her plot, such as it is, serve her emotional impulses, which are to her emotional impulses is show males and females in constant sexual attraction and repulsion for each other. So she's invented this plot where they're all up in a spaceship because Earth has been, I don't know, wiped out by radiation. And on the ship, the women cannot get pregnant. Therefore, they have to fight off the men. And there's this huge masturbation room, which gives you atomic-powered masturbation. And therefore, and the women can't get pregnant, but the sperm of the men has to be milked from them by Juliette Binoche as the mad scientist and then transmitted into the women. And then the fetus is taken out and baked in some machine and becomes a baby. It's okay, I'll stop. This is probably the worst thing you've ever heard on your program.
Oh my God.
And this is one of the worst movies I have ever seen by a very talented director. But I think it's my Catholicism or whatever morality is left in me by my Catholic training that says this woman is not expressing what she wants to express. She's just expressing her most superficial obsessions, but just her
prurient interest.
Well, yeah, I guess I have to say her prurient interest by manufacturing this plot, which makes no sense.
Did she write the film?
She wrote it, and she had five other script writers working on it. It takes six people to write this piece of nonsense?
You're killing me. How did you stay there?
Well, I said, I love Juliette Binoche, and she gives a good performance. Everybody else, Robert Pattinson and all the rest, are just taking orders and moving through the movie like zombies.
Okay.
But Juliette Binoche is a great, great actress, and she does give a performance as this tortured mad scientist, and she actually makes her a compelling figure. And I said, as soon as she dies, and I know everybody in this movie is going to die, as soon as she dies and is unloaded into outer space, as Robert Pattinson, as soon as somebody dies, he puts them in a capsule and throws them out into outer space. As soon as she goes, I leave the theater. And Juliette Binoche, sure enough, she dies and is launched into outer space. And I got up to go, but it turned out there was only five more minutes to go, and
okay.
I sensed that, and I stayed to the end.
Wow.
Bad
so you
movie.
Have walked out of films.
Yes, yeah. I usually don't review movies that I've walked out of, but yeah.
Life is too short,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Life is too short for some of these films.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say that I think it's my Catholic training that just shows me there's no moral structure to this movie. There's no moral backbone.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's no narrative backbone.
Yeah.
I'm not condemning it as a horribly immoral movie which will make people immoral and corrupt the morals of everybody in the audience. It's not that. It's too ridiculous to do that. But there has to be some sort of moral center to a good movie, whether it's Groundhog Day or Citizen Kane or anything that you see. Even the most lightweight comedy has to have some sort of spine to it, some sort of something that tells you these people are worth caring about, even on the most superficial level. I mean, think of Groundhog Day. It's a masterpiece.
Yes.
It's a minor masterpiece. But it's lighthearted. It's silly. It's fluffy. But there's something in there. Bill Murray has to become a better person before he gets a new day and stops repeating Groundhog Day over and over and over again.
It's a philosophical movie.
It counts. It matters to you whether this guy gets better or worse. And I don't mean movies have to end happily
that
people have to get better. I've seen despairing movies.
Right.
There are nevertheless good movies.
Yeah.
You're tuned to a conversation with film critic Richard Oliva. We'll call it a portrait of the critic as a young and now not so young man. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Richard.
There's no listener-supported community radio without listener support. Donate online at WESUFM.org.
You've been at this a long time,
yeah,
my gosh.
Yeah.
Can you tell pretty quickly into a film whether it's going to be any good?
I usually can tell about 3 minutes into the movie.
Minutes.
But I hang in there. Even if it looks like it's bad in the first 3 minutes, I force myself to sort of sit forward and try to take in what the director's trying to do.
What's the most recent review you wrote?
Well, right now I'm doing retrospectives because the regular reviewer, Rand Cooper, has now taken over the Post.
Oh, that's right.
He writes,
semi-retired.
Yeah. And what I'm doing is writing for their website.
Okay.
Which means that I now I'm quite happy now because now I am just watching and re-reviewing classics on DVD.
Wow.
Which is paradise for me.
Yes.
And right now I'm doing a kind of, I did a retrospective which was inspired by being interviewed by you. I did a retrospective of Christmas movies, the 10 best underappreciated Christmas
movies. Don't give
movies.
Me the credit though. I think idea.
Yeah, but but I could take our interview and sort of transform it into copy. And right now, I'm taking on a very unusual thing. Laurence Olivier's Othello, which is on DVD, of course, and I feel can only be seen in our time on a DVD. It cannot be shown in the theater because it is superficially the most politically incorrect performance ever given in Shakespeare. It's blackface, which was not an unusual thing for white actors to do. I mean, Othello's almost always been played by white actors before the 1980s. But nowadays, since Othello is only played by black actors in both Britain and in America, Laurence Olivier's performance will look offensive to many, many people. I don't think it's morally offensive. In fact, I still find it a great performance. But it's been forced to be looked at. You have to look at it as a very specialized kind of entertainment now. A movie that, a performance that uses blackface not to deride black people, but simply to portray a black character as specifically and as idiosyncratically as possible. Therefore, thank God for DVDs, because now certain movies can only be seen, should only be seen on DVD. They've become impossible in a theater because too many people in the audience would be so offended that even people who are not offended cannot get a clear look at what's valuable in a film. Well, look at Birth of a Nation. I mean, morally, it's scum. Aesthetically and technically, it's a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, even now, its battle scenes are probably the greatest Civil War battle scenes ever filmed.
Wow.
So it has that value, that limited value. And you should, films, particularly students of cinema, should be able to see it at their leisure, in their home, in privacy. In a theater, it would come across so offensive as to be virtually pornography, social pornography.
What about those Nazi era films by the woman who's
Leni Riefenstahl? Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. Why should they be shown in theaters anymore? Except, of course, let's make an exception. Film classes in universities looking at Nazi propaganda and students analyzing Nazi propaganda. Certainly, the Triumph of the Will is very valuable for that purpose.
Right.
Otherwise, Triumph of the Will is a triumph of editing. I mean, it is one of the most flabbergasting pieces of film montage and editing that I've ever seen in my life.
In a good way.
In a good, the technical good way, yes. Yeah. It's a brilliant piece of editing. Otherwise, the movie has no value because it glorifies Hitler.
Yeah.
So at home, somebody who appreciates editing or maybe is learning about film editing should watch that in his or her own home. In privacy.
So interesting.
Yes.
I never thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have to say, regarding Othello, which I find to be one of the most disturbing Shakespeare plays, just heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you even wanted to see it is, I don't know, either a credit to you or makes me worry about you. Like, why, of all the films, you know, why would you watch?
Well, in that case, it's specifically because of Laurence Olivier's performance,
okay.
Which now looks very, very strange.
Gosh.
But Othello is, I agree with you, it is one of the most deeply disturbing movies because why does Othello not come to his wife and ask her, are you unfaithful to
right?
me or not? And more, so many people are put off by that they condemn Othello as not a tragic hero, but just as a stupid man.
Not a smart guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and cruel.
But Laurence Olivier's performance carries you away from that notion. It makes you feel that Othello is not stupid. Not particularly bright, but not stupid either. He's a specific kind of man who becomes helpless in the trap that Iago has set for him because Othello has deceived himself before Iago deceived him. And it's Olivier's performance that brings this out. I hope to have deeper insights when I finish my review.
I would love to post it on the website. We have only a few minutes left, and your piece in this anthology is so beautifully written. I wonder if you would read for us just a few pages about being a Catholic critic. And by the way, are there any other Catholic critics that we can...
Well, Rand Cooper is not a Roman Catholic, but...
That's right.
But he writes for Common Will, and I would recommend his critiques. And I would be hard put to recommend any current ones other than his notices. But if you want to read movie reviews of the past, I would recommend Graham Greene's. Maybe some of them are available on the internet. But he was a great film critic in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And his criticisms have been collected. And I hope they're reissued one of these days. The greatest Anglo-Catholic reviewer is James Agee in our country.
Right.
I'll read two paragraphs if it's okay with you.
Please.
One negative, one positive. The first one, negative, because it sort of condemns the other Catholic critics of the 1960s, whom I never read. And here's the reason why. I mean, I read them, but only to become bored and frustrated by them. And I just would toss them aside just as I would toss myself aside. If I could see into the future and see that I had become a movie critic, I would say, another Catholic critic? I'm not going to read Richard Oliva. It was sort of a back-to-the-future thing.
That's the title of your piece.
Yeah, I would toss myself aside, just as I would toss all these other Catholic critics aside, probably unfairly. But here's why. As the 60s proceeded, Catholic critics and academics often latched onto certain films to explore or exemplify theological matters, but always the same films, La Strada, La Dolce Vita, and always, always the Seventh Seal. I respect these movies, but as written about in the Catholic press, they weren't so much works of art as just so much symbolic ore to be mined for the sake of theological nuggets. But the real being of any good movie resides in the way it moves in time. You can talk all you want about the monster fish on the beach at the close of La Dolce Vita, but you get closer to the temperament, yes, even the essence of that movie, when you notice how the camera hovers, seemingly hypnotized, near the face of Anita Ekberg as, with rock music blasting away, she dances herself into sort of a kinetic stupor. You feel that if a camera could pant, then Fellini's camera would pant as he tries to position itself on the neck of the Amazonian film star. And this enthrallment of the camera by so much flesh and heat has more to do with the much-noted ambivalence of La Dolce Vita than any symbolic fish.
The ambivalence of La Dolce Vita.
Yeah, people talk about the ambivalence of it all. I mean, is he condemning high society in La Dolce Vita, the decadent aristocrats and so forth? Or is he in love with it himself? Well, you're not going to learn that by interpreting the symbols in the movie. Oh, they're there. I mean, they're the statue of Christ being carried by a helicopter, the dead fish, giant fish on the beach, which Marcello Mastroianni and the other revelers stare at. That's not so valuable as looking at what Fellini actually does with his camera and his actors.
Hmm.
And the way his camera almost makes love to this Amazonian Anita Ekberg with all her voluptuousness, the way his camera's hypnotized by her as she dances to the rock music tells you more about the ambivalence of Fellini. He's turned on by this decadence, and yet at the same time he's telling you, this is too much, this has got to end, this is terrible. And this is an important ambivalence. Well, the next thing is, I try to lay down the law about what a Catholic critic should do.
Oh, good.
Obviously, I'm preaching to myself. The Catholic critic always writes out of his or her own Catholicism, not toward what he perceives as the reader's Catholic concerns. He does not bring to film his intellectual passion as a Catholic, or his sense of moral obligation as a Catholic. He does not have to rouse his Catholic conscience every time he sees a movie. He does not stoke up his Catholic sensibility when he enters the theater. He does not say to himself as the lights go down and the screen lights up, and now it's time for the Catholic perspective. Rather, he goes to a movie or to a play or reads a novel or listens to a concert with his entire being, with all the passion that is in him or her. He watches from the perspective of his entire life. He does not, in fact, experience a work of art as a Catholic, but as the human being whose Catholicism is now part of his being, or isn't. The religious sense will not spring to attention on cue as he watches the film, but always subtly informs the way he takes it in. If it does not, he is simply the wrong person for the job. The Catholic critics I read as a boy did seem to consciously rouse their Catholic sensibilities. They did put their Catholic outlook on the alert. And that may have been why their criticism seemed to me, back then in the 60s, so uninspiring, so boring. They were writers who had filtered their souls. In effect, they weren't being truly Catholic, or small c Catholic critics. The best American film critic was James Agee, who was Episcopalian, and who wrote for a completely secular magazine, The Nation. His religious sense was at one with his passionate response to life, and that passion made his criticism still the best film criticism ever written in English. His childhood friend, Dwight MacDonald, there's that name again, Dwight MacDonald wrote that Agee was, quote, deeply religious, but he had his own kind of religion, one that included irreverence, blasphemy, obscenity, and even communism of his own kind. MacDonald's description of his friend informs my vision of a serious man and a serious critic. So I think that sums it up.
Wow.
I hope I've done justice to Catholic critics.
I bless the day that you went to that barber shop and that the barber had Esquire magazine, because look what it's yielded for us.
A memory of Yvette Mimieux in a bikini.
You scamp. Thanks, Richard.
Always a pleasure.
So good.
That was a visit with Richard Oliva about his long career as a film critic who's never afraid to call him as he sees him. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.